Battle Creek Bombers 3-2 last night. Those teams play again tonight in Battle Creek. Major League Ball, the Brewers make it a sweep of the Orioles with a 4-0 win. Cubbies beat Tampa Bay 7-3. White Sox lose to Oakland 7-4. This afternoon, the Brewers and the Cubs meet down at Wrigley. White Sox are off. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Thursday, July 6th. Sunny, hot, and humid. Today's high 89, heat index near 96. 50-50 chance of rain tonight with a low of 68. Right now the new numbers are in. Wind from the west at 6, humidity at 96%, sunshine at 75 degrees. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. The morning show is next. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's at 2401 60th Street, also online at andreasgift.com.
As many of you know, my other life outside of WGTD's radio studios is as an assistant professor of music at Carthage College, right down the road here from Gateway Technical College. So it was with great interest that my eyes lit up when a certain book crossed my path called Campus Confidential, How College Works or Doesn't for Professors, Parents, and Students. This is written by someone on the inside of the academic world, namely Jacques Berlinerblau, professor and director of the Center for Jewish Civilization at the Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. Professor Berlinerblau cares deeply about education and about how we're doing in educating young people across the country. And he, for one, believes that we could be doing a much, much better job, that professors could be teaching more effectively, and that colleges and universities could be, in a sense, constructed in such a way where the delivery of first-rate education would be more possible, and that great teaching would be adequately rewarded, and that the way professors do their work, they wouldn't find obstacles in their path, but would find themselves in situations that allowed them to teach to the very highest level of their ability. That just is the tip of the iceberg in terms of all that he discusses in his very intriguing and also very entertaining book, again called Campus Confidential, How College Works or Doesn't for Professors, Parents, and Students. The book is published by Melville House, and I'm very honored to speak for the next few minutes with Jacques Berlinerblau about his book. Professor Berlinerblau, we welcome you to the morning show.
Hi, Greg. How are you?
Fine. I'm happy to have this opportunity to speak with you. First of all, just give us a capsule summary of how you found yourself in the world of academia professionally. I mean, from the womb, were you destined for this life, or or was there any particular catalyst that led you down this path?
Yeah, I think like many humanities PhDs, I'm an idiot savant. There's probably nothing else I could do. My skill set isn't that broad. So I became a professor likely because there was no other vocation in which I had the remotest chance of succeeding.
And tell us a little bit about what you do at Georgetown University.
Oh, I work in the School of Foreign Service. I'm a professor and I direct the Center for Jewish Civilization, and we work on American Middle Eastern foreign policy as it pertains to Israel, Holocaust studies, Jewish American literature, you name it. And we're right here in Washington, D.C., in the thick of things.
Very good. Well, at some point, you must have felt a certain level of dissatisfaction/frustration with sort of the current state of affairs to be prompted to write this book. Was it dissatisfaction specifically within your own sort of immediate sphere? I mean, was that the primary impetus for this book, or kind of the overall state of affairs as far as higher education is concerned?
No, it's been dissatisfaction all the way down. I guess I'm just a buzzkill, an unhappy person, right? From the moment I started graduate school, and I was very young, I started graduate school at 19. I just sensed things were off. So I've been basically running now 31 years in American higher education with a really, really bad intuition about American higher education. After graduate school, when I received my doctorate, I was an adjunct professor for 7 years, what is known as contingent faculty. And I write about that a lot in the book. Eventually, I found my way to Georgetown. I think it was very serendipitous, Greg, that I got here. And there's a lot of that in American higher education, professors just ending up at places sort of by luck. And I looked around at the landscape of college and university teaching, and I and many others found it to be really, really lacking in a variety of regards.
In some ways, an interesting corollary to what you just said happens is discussed kind of well into the book when you talk about the typical campus tour and the bright, perky upperclassman who is leading a group around campus, typically walking backwards as they point out this and that and the other thing. And you mentioned a couple of things that probably anybody who's gone on a campus tour has heard some variant on, that that our buildings are heated with in such a way, and such a famous person,
geothermal energy.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and such a famous person gave a speech over here, and we have new ping pong tables in the student union, and so on. You say that little or no attention tends to be given in those campus tours to what should be the central matter for anyone looking for a college or university, namely what kind of teaching goes on there. And in a sense, your book is about the fact that not only does that tend not to be discussed much in campus tours, but I think that's in a sense emblematic of what you see as sometimes a neglect of that central purpose of higher education.
Yeah, not only is it not discussed, it's occluded. But I have a riff in there, which is important, that it's actually really hard to know what happens in an American undergraduate classroom. I mean, like, almost no one knows. I mean, it's like the murky depths of the deepest ocean trench. That has a lot to do with academic conventions whereby we are the sovereign lords of our classrooms. And I guess there's something good about that. But so little, I feel, is actually known and understood about what transpires in the undergraduate classroom, that I think it's incumbent upon colleges in particular to try and enlighten parents about those things. And there are clear go-tos, Greg. There are clear metrics that parents need to know about, and high school seniors as well, prior to plunking down what might be $250,000 in college tuition.
How quickly, it sounds like very quickly, but was it right from the start that you began to have this uneasy feeling that at least much of the world of higher education is slightly askew in its priorities?
Yeah, right from the start. I guess it was during my first tour of duty in graduate school where I started realizing how incredibly micro-specialized everything was becoming really fast, right? We were just going deep, deep, deep into these issues, which I found very enjoyable, by the way. I did not see how those issues connected to anything in the outside world, which is fine. More importantly, that sort of sublimation or that process of going so deep into the weeds for about 10 years, which is the average stay when you receive a doctorate, basically rendered me incapable of communicating with an undergraduate or anybody else for that matter. And one of the strangest things about the way we train our doctoral students is we systematically remove them from the world, and we almost endow them with tendencies and dispositions that are precisely the tendencies and dispositions that would make for a bad college lecturer/teacher/mentor.
So in other words, in a sense, that relentless pursuit of sort of the ultimate level of expertise in a very focused subject matter, by its very nature, is going to perhaps render that teacher more and more out of touch with the young students whom they're going to be entrusted with teaching. I mean, that then, in a sense, you ascend this ladder, which makes you more and more out of touch with the very people then that you're supposed to be able to connect with and teach.
Yeah, the job description is pretty simple as I see it, with the possible exception of the most elite 1% of American doctorates. You're going to be spending a whole lot of your time teaching 18 to 24-year-olds. You like that? I mean, that's basically what this job entails. And the fact that we never train our doctoral students to think about how that experience is going to work and how they're going to execute that task is a real part of the problem. But there are lots of problems. And as you can tell, I am just a malcontent, right? But that's one right there. That's a big one.
Right. Right.
Complete lack of training and pedagogy.
So. So in other words, someone who is going to be, for instance, teaching Jewish history learns all that they can possibly learn about Jewish history, but along the way is never taught how to teach about Jewish history.
I do want to say something else. I mean, we see athletes, professional athletes, and we have this awe, right, for their physical grace and their skill and their dexterity. We should have that for these Jewish history micro-specialists. I mean, what they know is astonishing. Right, what they have managed to amass in their brains and the languages they speak and the connections they make and the secondary literature they've read, Greg, it really is amazing. But it's one of these like incredible skills that unfortunately doesn't have tremendous use, like being really good at hacky sack or playing the spoons or something like that. Right? There's not at the present moment a tremendous market for that level of intense micro-specialized knowledge.
At one point, you call the typical doctoral program ivy-covered factories without the smokestacks. That, in other words, they are churning out, in a sense, these hyper-experts in various fields, but not necessarily churning out first-rate teachers. And, in fact, I think what you're saying is they absolutely don't turn out first-rate teachers, or if they do, it's, in a sense, completely by accident.
Yeah, let me double down on that. I'll go even further. Even as researchers, I think a lot of the creative dimension is assiduously strained out of your soul in those 10 years. What struck me about graduate school, and I actually did two tours of duty in graduate school. I have two doctorates, right? So I did it twice. So I think I have a platform by which to speak about it. What struck me about graduate school was how technical the training became the higher up the ladder I went. It was almost vocational. I was learning to master certain languages. I was learning to conjugate certain verbs. I was learning to compare certain types of documents. So the higher up the flagpole I went, the less creativity was a part of what my job training entailed. And maybe that works very well in economics or STEM disciplines, right? I'm not saying that's not necessary there. But in the humanities, I would surmise that creativity, innovation, originality, those are the types of skills that we want to cultivate in our young scholars.
And they are not being cultivated.
I don't think so, right? It's the nature of micro-specialization in the 20th and 21st century. Somewhere along the way, we took a wrong turn or we didn't ask a key question. And the question would have gone something like this. How much specialization is good? And how much specialization in a subject matter is actually deleterious or does great damage to your intellectual project, to your intellect, to your ability to communicate? I believe there is a point beyond which knowing too much about a subject matter actually becomes inimical to whatever it is you're trying to achieve, right? You start to completely undermine yourself intellectually. You fail to draw connections. You get locked into certain boxes. And I see this again and again and again with graduate students, and I always find it really, really puzzling and sad, actually.
Hmm. You know, as you describe that, I am reminded of a speech that was given at the college where I teach, given by a highly regarded professor of history there, to speaking to the entire student body, actually. And in it was a case of him trying to kind of explain to the students how they could better understand who their professors were. Mm. And in the course of this speech, he basically said, you need to understand that those of us who are teaching you here, we're all nerds. We're all nerds. I mean, you know, think about somebody that you know that you think of as kind of a nerd about something where they just have to know everything there is about it versus, I mean, Star Trek, the original series, or the greatest pitchers in baseball history, whatever it might be. We're like that, but with our own particular areas of expertise. And it was kind of a disarmingly honest and charming way to talk about something. And I think he was describing it in a context that he regarded as very positive. And I think you are talking about this, in a sense, taken too far to the point where it's no longer charming, and really is more of a deficit when it comes to the task of being able to connect with one's students and being able to effectively teach them.
Yeah, there's a fine. I mean, I'm a nerd, all right. I mean, admittedly a nerd. You sound like a nerd to me as well, Greg, right? But there's a fine line between being a nerd and being a person that completely lacks any form of emotional intelligence and has no capacity to communicate with anyone else. So I'm all for the nerd aspect. I think Revenge of the Nerds is one of the great campus movies, by the way, in its unyielding negativity and nastiness. I've always liked that movie. So I think nerds are cool. No problem there. I think we're actually producing something far worse than a nerd. Now, another thing I want to mention, I talked about this in the book, since we're both interested in graduate school, is the tremendous rates of mental health difficulties that graduate students, particularly in the humanities, are having. The whole experience seems to exact a brutal toll on a young doctoral student's psyche, to the effect of between 47% to 60% are reporting mental health difficulties. That was a Berkeley study from a couple of years back. So I don't fully understand what the upside here is. We haven't even begun to discuss the job market and how bleak that is. So I feel the time has come for a sort of radical rethinking of the entire doctoral experience, and in addition, the entire tenure system. And that's something we need to get into, I guess. But the reason I say that, I never want to lose the organic connection, is those two factors are inextricably bound to the quality of undergraduate education. And what I try to do in the book is I try to reintegrate the professor with the student. And I want to argue that if your professor is suffering, if your professor is underpaid, if your professor has no job security, that's going to have really clear effects in terms of his or her teaching in the lecture hall.
Hmm. So that's an issue even beyond what we were talking about before, that certain people, maybe many people, teaching at the collegiate level have not received adequate training to be the best teachers they could possibly be. But then beyond it, there are also these forces, largely negative forces, that probably get in the way of them as well from being as effective as they might otherwise be in the classroom.
Right, and those forces are the economic forces. So for your listeners that might not know, you know this very well. Our way of life appears to be coming to an end. And if by our way of life, I mean since 1940, we've had a system in place referred to as tenure. And the tenure system, which was really robust in the 70s, where roughly half of all American professors were on the tenure line, is imploding before our eyes to the point to which we believe it might not even exist in a quarter century, or it'll only exist at elite institutions. So as a vocation, our way of life is getting rolled, right? And scholars of my generation, and I imagine your generation, are just watching, they should be watching, I think, in complete dismay at what is happening to the next generation behind us and the generation behind them. And what is happening is there are no more tenure line jobs. These poor people who are very good scholars are being hired at just laughable, risible wages. They have no job security. It's a mess. It's a complete mess. Boy, I really am a buzzkill, aren't I?
We should probably...
My wife was right.
Right. We should probably, for the sake of our listeners who are not part of the world of academia, just explain why a system like tenure would have been put into place in the first place. And,
oh.
and again, you know, for the sake of those who are not part of this life, and we should remind people that tenure for a professor means essentially a very profound kind of job security, that they do not have to come back year after year and hope they will be reengaged. It is, in a sense, a gesture that you will have you will continue to teach at this institution as long as you care to, in a sense. Why was the system of tenure necessary to create in the first place, and what was its benefit beyond job security for that particular professor?
Yeah, there's the most fascinating research on this. I believe the guy's name is Metzger. So I'm not going to give you the fascinating and complex. I'm going to give you the general. One major problem is prior to 1940, particularly during World War One and after, a professor who said something that was unpopular or controversial would find himself or herself out on her keister. So what she or he lacked was any semblance of what we now refer to as academic freedom. And what the tenure system did, and this is why I'm still committed to it as best I can be, is it defended the right of scholars speaking in their area of expertise to say whatever they felt was true. And that is clearly a benefit for a liberal democracy. So from 1940 forward, we had a system whereby after 6 years, your probationary period, if you were granted tenure, you essentially had guaranteed lifetime employment. And there are downsides to that. We can get to that. But most importantly, for those who wish to use it, you had complete unfettered expressive liberty in your area of specialization. And it's worked very well for me, Greg. I could have never written this book without tenure. Sometimes I wish more scholars would use their tenure, and not necessarily in political ways, not use their tenure to express a political thought, but more a kind of troubling intellectual thought. But that's another question for another day. So the tenure system really did have a virtue, and it had a job, and I think it did its job pretty well.
Right. And just to clarify, when you say without tenure, you never would have written this book.
Right.
Do you mean that because this book is somewhat controversial and says very critical things about the world that you are part of, including, I should think implicitly, the school at which you teach, mm-hmm. that if you did not have the protection of tenure, you would not feel safe to express what you have expressed so freely in this book? Is that what you're...
Yeah, bingo. That's it. That's exactly it. Though, I mean, I bleed Hoya blue. I like my school, believe it or not, right? And there are other faculty members here that we love our school and we're very into teaching. And one thing I notice about professors, I don't know how it is on your campus, is we don't abound in school spirit. And that's a great thing for parents to think about, right? If you ever meet a professor from a college, how do they speak about their school, right? And school spirit has just, like, disappeared. So I do want to be clear. I'm very honored to teach here. I have lots of criticisms about my university, but I've taught at many schools across my career, and I see the same problems popping up everywhere.
Right. I have to say, too, as I read your book and as I'm listening to you talk, I don't want this to turn into a commercial for the school where I teach, right. But one of the things that is said often is that that we are a school that highly values teaching. Mm. And honestly, to me, I would always be surprised that would be said so vociferously. And of course, one might argue whether or not, in fact, those high-standing words are deserve to be spoken, but I happen to think they do. But I remember thinking, well, of course we value teaching. We're a college. And I think it's the only place I've ever taught, and I think I am to some extent oblivious to a grimmer reality that you paint in your book of other places where teaching is not valued to the same extent, and that all kinds of other matters get into the way of what should be the central feature of any respectable university or college.
The problem for parents is that every college says that about themselves, right? So if you go to the websites, which I was doing, and this was a lot of fun, and you'd read the kind of blurb, which is usually written by a PR specialist living hundreds of miles from campus, the blurbs always talk about our commitment to the individual student and how we develop the student soul. And parents have to be super discerning about which schools are telling the truth and which are not. Now, Carthage, I happen to know a little bit about, and I believe it's an example of what I refer to in the book as a SLAC, a small liberal arts college. And from what I've heard anecdotally, and it's very hard to know, yeah, this is a place that takes teaching seriously, right? And the question for parents is, why is that, right? How did that happen? That's how bad things are. How did it happen that a school actually had an administration that decided they were going to motivate their faculty and spend the money to really take care of those students in the classroom? So what I try to do in the book is show parents the types of things that colleges and universities say about themselves vis-a-vis teaching, and then give them the counterfactuals and say, okay, if they're really serious about teaching, this is what you would see at a aforesaid institution of higher education.
Mm. So help our listeners understand the state of affairs at a school where, sadly, teaching is not valued. What would be the clearest symptoms of that?
Yeah, all right, great. Well, the first thing, I'm very skeptical about the super elite schools, right, because the star faculty is not working with the students, right? Their celebrity has earned them the right to completely stiff-arm and avoid undergraduates. So that's one thing parents just have to understand. So, you know, Junior, Caitlin, Connor, whatever your kid's name is, they got accepted to this, like, incredible top 10 school. Think really carefully about who's going to be teaching them in the classroom, right? Because chances are it's not going to be the person you heard giving the TED Talk or on NPR.
Right. In fact, we should say a couple of your chapters are titled Who is Your Professor?
Who is your professor?
And so you are, in a sense, suggesting that the answer to that question says a lot about the quality of education that your son or daughter will receive at this school.
Right. Actually, sometimes it's better that those star faculty aren't your professor, right? Because those people have no interest in undergraduates, right? So I'm not saying that the people teaching your kids are schlubs, right? That's not what I'm saying at all. I'm just saying often your professor is some exploited, underpaid adjunct who would love to give so much more to this job, but she or he can't because she's constantly looking for another job or doesn't know if she'll be working here next semester. So parents really have to think about the employment conditions, the HR conditions that prevail at these universities. The other thing I would just stress, I keep stressing it, it's so simple, you know it, I know it, is class size. It's kind of this one statistic that is just like wherever you look, it's important, especially in the humanities. If you're sitting in classes with 90 or 100 people, you're being what's known as massified. Massification, by the way, has become a trend in American higher education. And quite frankly, I don't want to plunk down $250,000 if my son or daughter is going to be in massified classes for 75% of her undergraduate stay. So that's a real big tell for a parent, right? How big the classes are. Don't look at faculty to student ratio because that number can be gamed really cynically, right? Try to figure out of the 40 classes my kid's going to take, in what percentage of those classes will my kid be sitting in a room with about 15 people? And I don't know if you agree with me on this, Greg, but I think 15 in the humanities is the sweet spot, all right? That's really where you can educate and get a lot out of the group experience.
Absolutely. I would completely agree with that. I would say that as a teacher in music, I've often taught classes that were smaller than that,
right.
And that can be powerful and effective too. But yeah. But when you get to that point of 12, 13, 14, 15, you also have enough minds in the same room that a certain kind of synergy tends to be created. and the discussions become more intriguing and the experience just richer overall. But then you get bigger than that, and then it becomes much more challenging to keep that level of engagement strong with everybody there. I'm speaking with Jacques Berliner-Blau about his book, Campus Confidential, How College Works or Doesn't for Professors, Parents, and Students. Professor Berliner-Blau, at several points in the book, you reiterate that you actually like teaching young adults, 18 through 24. I think you hasten to repeat that because you don't want to sound, you don't want us to assume that you hate being a college professor and hate everything about it, and that's simply not true. But this is a book in which you really try to spell out your frustrations. I'm curious, how would you say, this is a frank way to ask the question, but how good a professor would you say you are and have been over the course of your career? And if graduate school is not, generally speaking, an effective means to become a good teacher, how have you managed to teach at whatever level of excellence you've managed to attain? I mean, how have you managed to do that if it wasn't through your own graduate training?
Now, that's a fun question. Great. So a self-flagellating question. I think at the beginning of my career, I don't think I was a very good teacher. I think I was way too narcissistic, which is a big problem that academics have, especially young men, right, getting out of graduate school at a young age, are just so full of themselves, and it's really all about them. So I think for the first 10 years, I kind of sucked. All right, so we got that. I'm not a good graduate-level teacher. I taught graduate school for, I don't know, 5-10 years. So those would be MA and PhD students. And they totally harshed my mellow. I just found them dull. They never asked big questions. You hear a lot of professors say that. Maybe in the last 10 or 15 years at Georgetown, I think I became a good college teacher. I don't like the hype about best college teachers. I have a chapter about that. I don't like the awards for best college teachers. I became, shall we say, an emotionally intelligent college teacher, and that's as far as I'll go. One thing I will say about myself and many of my colleagues is I really invest in creating a syllabus, getting to know my students, being in my office hours, being on time. That's the sort of unglamorous drudge work of being a good professor. Everyone thinks it's like Mona Lisa Smile or Dead Poets Society, where you've got professors standing on desks and, you know, like dispensing wisdom like an NBA point guard. But it's actually a lot of good college teaching is just doing really, really boring work so that you put your students in a position to learn. So is that a fair enough assessment, Greg? Self-flagellating enough? I could do better or worse.
No, that was good. That was good. Before we run out of time, there are a couple of things I want to be sure to ask you to kind of expound on. This is a moment in the book from a chapter called Teach or Perish when you write this. I don't want to sound like a TED talker, but the fundamental shift in higher education is going to go down something like this. We're moving from an era in which we prized accumulating knowledge to one in which we equally prize its transmission and reception. Professors are failing to deliver, as it were. This leaves us fatally exposed to challenges that are unnerving and, in some cases, unprecedented. Can you untie all of that for us? You're saying a lot right there.
Well, the first thing is there's this new trend in American higher education. It's called active learning. It goes by many names, right? Sometimes it's called flipped classroom, so that's a little bit imprecise. And, I don't think parents know this is happening, but it's really kind of cool. I really don't like these old fuddy-duddies that write op-eds. You know, in my day, we used to lecture for 95 minutes, and we loved it. You know, and the kids didn't learn a thing, and you know, we stroked out because we spoke so much. So there's a new trend in the classroom whereby we're drawing much more on our students' thoughts and opinions. It really works well for me. I'm not saying it works for every professor, but interestingly, as I walk down the hallway at this university and others, I notice that more and more and more professors are doing it. All right, so that's referred to as active learning. Now, it only took us, Greg, 500 years to figure this out, right? If the university as we know it has been around, you know, it's probably more than 500. So it took us about half a millennia to get it, but I think we've got it now. I just don't know if it's too late. In that passage, where I speak about existential threats, right, somebody else has realized this, that it's all about the transmission of knowledge, not the great scholar who accumulates knowledge. And these would be venture capitalists and tech bros and the digital gurus, more power to them, right, who are trying to reconfigure American higher education. So it just goes online, and it costs a lot less, and they cut out all the middlemen and the middlewomen, and somebody, I gather, makes a killing off of all of this. And that's the existential threat that I was addressing. There's another existential threat, and it's called your state legislature, because they're pretty fed up of shoveling money to the U to have professors that aren't really doing a very good job of teaching. So we have these pincers that are coming at us, right? One is the free market via the cyber revolution. That's coming at us. And from the other side, we have politicians, and these are Democrats as well as Republicans, who are saying a good college education results in a job. Can you show us that your professors are committed to helping your students achieve that outcome? So this is frightening. And unfortunately, I don't think enough people in higher ed are worried about this.
Hmm. I wonder if you could also talk about a specific kind of crisis that you see afflicting much of higher education that the general public hears very, very little about, and even if they're told about it, probably don't quite understand, and maybe they shouldn't, or it's understandable that they don't. But mm-hmm. you call it the crisis of standardlessness, working in a sense without a clear sense of standards. What are you talking about there?
In a nutshell, campuses are funny places because professors are funny people, right? We're oddballs. There's no doubt about that. You're an oddball. I'm an oddball. We're all weird, all right? So that's good, right? We're nerds. We're good nerds. We were never particularly good at sort of selecting candidates and getting the right person for the job, all right? So that was never our strong suit. The problem now is there are no jobs, all right? So whenever a tenure-track job appears, you have like 200, 300, 400, I've heard 800, right, 900 people applying for the job, right? So what happens is we select somebody, but often enough, because we don't take the process super seriously and we're not particularly good at discriminating between who has talent and who doesn't, and there are a lot of politics in American higher ed, often enough we don't get the right person. So the crisis of standardlessness in a nutshell is this. It just might be that your assistant professor, anthropologist at Princeton, has been outpublished by your assistant professor, anthropologist at what's number 149? Oklahoma State University, right? So Princeton is number one. Oklahoma State is 149. They both hired a cultural anthropologist, let's say. I'm making this up, obviously. And you put their CVs side by side, and as researchers, they have exactly the same accomplishments, or maybe the OSU person has more. It's very, very peculiar. And the reason that this is happening is because there simply are no jobs out there. So every job gets hundreds and hundreds of applicants. The search committees do a typically disastrous job of sifting through them. So it's not as if the very best people are at the very best universities, at least on the junior level. Things change a little bit on the senior level. I wrote a piece about this in the Chronicle of Higher Education recently and seemed to get the entire American Academy upset at me for that. But I feel it's a truth that needs to be told. It's a really, really inconvenient truth, and I'm willing to say it about myself. I'm sure there are people who are better published than I am who are laboring at these godforsaken universities somewhere and aren't getting to enjoy all the great things about Georgetown University.
Hmm. A last question. How has this book been received by your colleagues at Georgetown, by the administration there, by your counterparts at other schools? I mean, are you hearing people say, hear, hear, thank you for saying what needed to be said a long time ago? Or are you hearing from people who wonder, what in the world's going on with you? I love what I'm doing, and I love what we're doing, and so on. How has this, generally speaking, been received, or is it impossible to summarize?
Well, the people who say the latter are called administrators, right? So, oh, I love my school. There's no problem here, right? We're firing on all pistons, right? You're a buzzkill. I noticed that researchers at the elite schools who have worked very hard in their lives tend not to like the argument that I've noticed. I have a lot of correspondence from contingent faculty. And I think I can speak to that constituency because I was a contingent faculty member for a good long time, and I think I have some basic sense of what their travails are. Very curious to me, Greg, is folks on the right more than on the left are championing the argument. I guess that's because the right has long had a withering criticism of liberal bias in American higher ed. So they take to the book a lot faster, which is peculiar to me because the book is a pox on everyone's house, right? I'm criticizing every imaginable configuration in higher ed. I really do try to be as fair as I can be. But I've noticed that people who are kind of center-right and even further to the right find the arguments in the book very, very compelling. And as we're only in week two, as the rollout continues, I'll get back to you, Greg, and tell you what else I'm learning. But that's what I've learned so far.
Very good. In the meantime, your book gives us a lot to think about, those of us who are part of higher education and those who are simply interested in it for one reason or another. The book, again, is called Campus Confidential, How College Works or Doesn't for Professors, Parents, and Students, published by Melville House, the author, Jacques Berliner-Blau. Professor Berliner-Blau, I enjoyed this very much. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Greg. This is a lot of fun. Take care.
And it's not often enough that we talk about our lovely neighbors to the north, the folks of Canada. And we're going to spend a few minutes talking about them with Jesse Brown, who likes to call himself a journalist and public irritant. And he's responsible for a very popular podcast called Canada Land. And his unique and humorous take on Canada is in a book called The Canada Land Guide to Canada. And it's published by Touchstone, and it's a really, really fun book and intriguing. And I'm glad Jesse Brown can join me for a precious few minutes to talk about Canada, a much understood nation. Jesse Brown, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks for having me.
Explain your own personal connection to Canada.
Well, I was born here and I live here. Like a lot of people, I was taught that we are the nicest people on earth and the kindest, if the most boring. And we're about to celebrate 150th birthday, so we're sort of awash in a lot of patriotic messaging. And Canadians don't do patriotism very well, so it seemed like a good chance to tell the truth about this country, have a honest look at it, and write a very rude book about a very polite country.
I like that take of it. You at one point have a big headline that says Canada, a beige nation. Do you think it's really beige or just seen as beige?
I think that we want people to think of us as boring and beige. I think the world is looking increasingly crazy, and the idea of having a country that's a lot like America, but just, you know, no guns and nicer, more polite, not as heated, that's a very, very attractive idea to a lot of people. It's what we want you to think of ourselves, but it's not really true. We have a lot of problems. We got a lot of the same tensions and strains. We're thought of as being these environmental champions. Meanwhile, like our oil sands, we are pushing the planet towards global warming, which we actually like because it's really cold up here. We are major manufacturers of weapons and arms. We ship these tanks to Saudi Arabia that are being used in Yemen. It's just completely different than what everybody thinks about us.
Actually, on a semi-serious note, at one point you say we are, when it comes to your comparison with people in the United States, we are, meaning Canadians, more polite, but we are far less kind. Did you really mean that? I mean, to what extent are you serious there, and what causes you to say that?
I'm pretty serious about that one. We still have this British lineage where we're really concerned about etiquette and propriety. But when I go to the States, certain parts in particular, but it doesn't really matter if I'm in the South, people are so warm and sweet and talkative. They actually want to engage. When I'm in New York, people are aggressive and brusque, but they're trying to help. If you look lost, they'll talk to you and ask you where you want to go. In Canada, we don't even look each other in the eye. We're always bumping into each other. That's why we say sorry so much. We're always stepping right over each other's feet.
So, you spend a lot of time talking about the Queen and Canada's intriguing relationship with the Queen. Just say a quick word about Mr. Trudeau.
Well, he's a beautiful, shiny pony. He's very cute. He's got a lovely head of hair, a sparkling smile. Ladies love him. And he's really the quintessential Canadian in terms of that image, you know, the nice guy. The nice guy never says a nasty word. And I think that we're sort of like at peak Canada with this guy because the actual policies are about digging up oil from the oil sands and putting it through pipelines. He's completely in agreement with Trump on everything, including refugees and immigration. A liberal party in Canada is a lot more conservative than you might think. And he's giving us a really good public image, but at the expense of actually working on any problems here, because it's sort of you look one way and you act a different way.
Interesting. Say a word about the incredible place of hockey in your national life and the struggles of other sports to take hold.
Well, it's because we suppress so much rage and hostility to maintain this nice guy image. We have to work it out somehow. So we train our children from a very young age to beat the crap out of each other at hockey rinks. And then the parents beat the crap out of each other in the stands. So hockey is dominant. You guys really seem to care about football. Here, the Canadian Football League, nobody even goes to those games. Those players don't make enough money to play professionally. They have to like work as bouncers and furniture movers in the off season.
I would be remiss if we didn't take at least a second to give you a chance to talk about the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, which you call an easy listening radio station for the elderly. I suspect the good folks of the CBC wouldn't quite appreciate that characterization, but there's probably a grain of truth there.
Well, yeah, my former employers at the CBC probably not that happy to hear that, but fortunately it's a very bureaucratized and geriatric organization, so I don't have to watch my back too much. Or if I can walk at a fast pace, I can outrun anyone from the CBC.
So say a word more about, because it's one of the funniest moments in the book when you talk about how the typical Canadian would actually welcome a little bit of climate change, or particularly global warming. I'm not going to read the graphic way in which you put it, but just say a quick word about why most Canadians are rooting for this, in fact, to be true.
Well, listen, climate change is great for Canada. Our climate's miserable. We would love to change it. So we're doing our best to change it. And that's another thing people don't know much about us, is that we are releasing an incredible amount of carbon pollution into the atmosphere.
So doing your part.
We're doing our part to push things along. Climate change is very good for Canada, unfortunately, for everybody else. But, we got a lot of land here that we can finally use. We don't like to admit that to outsiders, but it's the subconscious reality, I think.
The book, again, is The Canada Land Guide to Canada, published in America and written by Jesse Brown, published by Touchstone. Jesse Brown, thanks a lot. This was fun.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's is located at 2401 60th Street, Kenosha. Online, you'll find them at andreasgifts.com. Support for the Morning Show also comes from Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Check the forecast now from the National Weather Service, and then we will join Wisconsin Public Radio at 9:01. It's going to be sunny, hot, and humid today, a high of 89. The heat index near 96 today. Partly cloudy tonight, 50-50 chance of rain with a low of 68. And then Friday, partly sunny and seasonal with a high of 80. Here are the numbers right now. Wind is from the west at 6 miles per hour. Humidity is high, 96%, 75 degrees with Sunshine coming up on 9 o'clock. We'll take a short break here, then we'll join Wisconsin Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the author of How to Be a Muslim, Haroon Mogal. His memoir is about being the son of Pakistani Muslim immigrants, trying to find his own religious path while dealing with bipolar disorder that nearly led him to suicide. He's now a fellow in Jewish-Muslim relations at the Shalom Hartman Institute. Join us.
Fresh Air, tonight at 7 on WGN.